If something cannot go on forever, it will stop.
Right, Herbert Stein.
Exactly, the former chairman of the U.S. Council of Economic Advisors. And that observation is, well, it's exactly how we need to open today's inquiry, because we are looking at a paradox that exists right in plain sight.
It challenges the most fundamental assumptions you might hold about, you know, what actually makes a business successful over the long term.
I mean, consider two absolute titans of industry, Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. They sell beverages and snacks to the exact same world. They ride the exact same macroeconomic trends. And remarkably, they possess almost identical capital intensity.
Yeah, both are spending just over 4% of their revenue on capital.
Right. And Wall Street assigns them the exact same label.
Uh-huh.
They're both universally referred to by analysts as compounders.
But that identical label completely conceals two entirely different economic machines. I mean, if you examine the decade-long data presented in The Infinite Investor, the divergence between these two companies is, well, it's profound.
The numbers really are staggering when you separate them out.
They are. Over a 10-year period, Coca-Cola grew its revenue by a modest 14%. Yet it managed to literally double its return on invested capital. It went from roughly 9% to nearly 19%.
Wow. And PepsiCo.
PepsiCo grew its revenue by a massive 54% over that exact same decade. But its return rate didn't budge a single percentage point. It started at 15.5%, and it remained perfectly flat at 15.5%.
So one improved its earnings on a fixed base, while the other significantly enlarged its base without improving the rate it earned on that money at all.
Exactly.
This deep dive into the averaging up collection is driven by a singular mission, really: to completely dismantle that dangerously vague label of the compounder.
It's a label that hides a lot of sins.
It does. We are going to deconstruct the exact mechanics of what success actually does to a business and examine why every truly great company eventually arrives at an unavoidable existential crossroads.
To understand why Coca-Cola and PepsiCo took such radically different paths, we first have to examine the internal physics of compounding itself. It requires three distinct dimensions. And critically, they must all multiply together.
Right. The formula.
Yes. First, you have the rate. That is simply what the business earns on the capital it employs. Second, you have the quantity. This is the actual volume of capital that the business can put back to work at that specific rate.
And the third?
Duration. How long can the business continue this internal reinvestment before its competitive moat is breached or, you know, the market opportunity simply runs out?
So if we visualize this, if you picture it as a three-dimensional box, the total volume of that box is the company's total compounding power.
Right. The base is the foundation.
Exactly. The base is the foundation, multiplied by the rate on the vertical axis and the duration stretching out into the distance. Now, a logical pushback here is one of simple financial engineering.
I know where you're going with this.
Well, I mean, if a management team recognizes that all three of those dimensions must multiply, and they want to rapidly expand the total volume of that box, why can't they just borrow aggressively to increase the quantity dimension?
Just take on cheap debt to build a bigger base.
Right. Why not just engineer a larger volume?
Because you run directly into what the text calls the debt trap. You can absolutely borrow size, but you cannot borrow rate, and you cannot borrow duration.
The mechanics break down.
They completely break down. The moment you introduce external leverage to artificially inflate the quantity of capital, you are no longer compounding, you are intermediating. The Infinite Investor highlights the striking example of Duke Energy to illustrate this.
The utility company.
Yes. They spend roughly $14 billion in capital against only $5 billion in net income. They run massive negative free cash flow. They have to issue debt to cover the shortfall. And yet, and this is the kicker, they pay their dividend anyway.
So the physical base of the business is growing.
It is growing, yes, but it is growing with someone else's money. This completely violates the mechanics of true compounding, which by definition must be funded from within.
It fundamentally changes the direction of quality in the business.
Yeah.
Let's apply the formula introduced in the text here. The toll versus the growth.
A crucial distinction.
The toll is the structural position the business holds that collects revenue. You can think of it as the toll booth on a highway. The growth is the economic wave it rides, and the massive capital that the growth inevitably consumes to build more highway.
And that distinction is everything. In a high-quality business, the toll absorbs the growth. The toll booth generates significantly more cash than the highway expansion consumes, and whatever cannot be consumed becomes a structural surplus.
but in a deteriorating business.
That flow reverses, the growth devours the toll. The business begins to burn more capital than it collects, and it drifts toward a barrier from which it simply cannot return.
Right, they are burning cash, but let me push on this a bit. What about the companies that aren't burning cash? I'm thinking of businesses that are highly profitable, have no obvious debt traps, yet they still manage to completely stall out.
It happens all the time.
If borrowing size is a false path, how do seemingly excellent businesses still fail to compound?
Well, they stall in two very distinct ways. The first is what we call the zero spread. Look at a company like Waste Connections. By any standard metric, this is a highly disciplined operation.
Sure, they generate real, tangible cash flow.
Real cash flow. It possesses a wide, undeniable economic moat. I mean, nobody wants a new landfill built in their backyard, but its return on invested capital sits almost exactly at its cost of capital.
Meaning what the business pays to fund itself, the actual cost to access that money, is exactly what it earns on that money.
Precisely. The spread between the two is zero. And mathematically, when your spread is zero, your reinvestment quantity is multiplying nothing. You can pour billions into the machine, but the volume of the compounding box does not grow.
Then there is the second stall, which, frankly, is perhaps even more deceptive to the casual observer, the increment trap.
The increment trap is dangerous because it looks like success. The prime example the infinite investor uses here is Canadian National.
Right, the railway.
Yes. This is a century-old rail network carrying a very high average return on capital. But when you look closely at the mechanics, that average return is an inheritance. It is a mathematical ghost.
A mathematical ghost. Because of the legacy assets.
Exactly. The new capital they deploy today to expand or maintain that network produces almost nothing.
That is the trap right there. The historical average entirely conceals the marginal increment. And as an investor today, you are not buying the historical average.
No, you don't get to buy the railroad in 1920.
Right, you're buying the marginal return on the next dollar deployed in 2026.
So if you are looking at a stock chart or a standard financial summary, you are actively being blinded by a century of history, when what you actually own as an investor today is just that next low-yield dollar being spent.
So how does an investor navigate this? I mean, how do you spot the difference between a high average return and a deteriorating incremental return before it's too late?
You spot it by demanding evidence of true compounding from within. You look for a business that enlarges its base while preserving or actively improving its spread. Consider Linde, the industrial gas giant.
They merged with Praxair.
A massive merger of near equals. And for 6 years, they meticulously digested this enormous acquisition, but they funded it entirely from their own operations. They did not tap the debt or equity markets to subsidize that growth.
So they grew from within.
Exactly. They emerged having effectively doubled their base, but with their spread completely intact. Or look at Union Pacific, contrasting directly with Canadian National.
Another railroad, but a different strategy.
Very different. Union Pacific operates a primary corridor that was laid in 1862. You cannot buy more of that specific geographical corridor at any price. So they poured their capital into what the existing corridor could carry rather than trying to buy more corridor.
They optimized the density of the network they already had.
Right. And as a result, their return on invested capital organically rose from 13.4% to 16.2%. Mm. True compounding grows out of what the base itself produced.
But here we arrive at the ultimate, unavoidable irony highlighted throughout the Averaging Up collection. The better a business is at compounding, the faster it destroys its own ability to do so.
It's the ultimate paradox.
Success itself becomes the structural constraint.
That is exactly the crossroads every great company faces. Take Visa, for example. It is a complete anomaly in the financial world. Visa possesses an extraordinary rate of return. But it has virtually zero reinvestment quantity.
Explain the mechanics of that.
Well, when a new fintech company launches or a bank issues a new suite of credit cards, those transactions cross digital rails that Visa has already laid and paid for decades ago.
Ah, I see.
Therefore, almost nothing new lands on Visa's balance sheet to facilitate that growth. The numerator, their earnings, rises constantly, while the denominator, their invested capital, stands completely still.
Okay, I have to push back on this. Because on the surface, that sounds perfect.
It sounds like the dream scenario.
It does. If Visa is creating immense value and its intrinsic value is rising rapidly without consuming any capital, why isn't that the holy grail? I mean, why isn't a perpetually rising numerator with a frozen denominator the absolute peak of compounding?
Uh-huh. This is where we have to separate value creation from internal compounding. Visa creates enormous value, undeniably. Intrinsic value rising without consuming capital is the cleanest form of value creation that exists.
But it's not compounding.
A business only compounds internally when it takes its own earnings and redeploys them back into itself to create new, yielding assets. Visa cannot do that.
Because the network is already built.
Exactly. Everything it earns, beyond the relatively small amount it uses to maintain its servers, must leave the company. It cannot force more capital into a network that simply doesn't require it. This reveals a fundamental paradox of capital allocation.
Which is?
A truly high return generates surplus cash far faster than a small base can possibly absorb it.
So the engine doesn't lose power. It simply runs out of anything to turn.
Yes. As a company matures, its rate of return might actually improve. Let's say it jumps to 30%. But the fraction of its own earnings it can actually reinvest collapses.
The runway is always finite. It's a mathematical certainty. If you extend it far enough, a business compounding at 15% in a broader economy growing at 4%, well, it eventually becomes the entire economy.
The law of large numbers arrives right on schedule. And crucially, it arrives fastest for the companies that executed everything perfectly. Every single true compounder eventually finds itself in the exact same predicament.
Holding a massive growing surplus of cash.
Cash that it cannot put back to work at the historical rates that produced it in the first place.
And when a business hits this wall, this inevitable crossroads, it has exactly three options for what to do with that surplus cash. And the choice management makes dictates the entire future of the business.
Option one is to simply acknowledge the constraint and return the surplus. MSCI does this through share repurchases, so persistent and aggressive that their shareholders' equity has actually been consumed below zero.
Or Coca-Cola paying out dividends.
Right. Coca-Cola acknowledges it by paying out roughly 2/3 of its earnings in dividends. What is crucial to understand here is that the compounding doesn't end. Rather, it is externalized.
It is externalized to you, the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And that fundamentally shifts the burden. The cash arrives in your brokerage account, it gets taxed upon arrival, and it now relies entirely on your personal ability to redeploy it at a high rate elsewhere, not the company's.
Which leads us to option two, the path of denial. This is where a management team refuses to accept its maturity and attempts to buy a new base entirely.
Oh, this is where capital goes to die.
Often, yes. S&P Global, an historically exceptional business, took its surplus and bought IHS Markit for $44
billion. $44 billion. And what happened to their returns?
Their return on invested capital instantly fell from 57% down to 10%. Canadian Pacific bought Kansas City Southern for $31 billion and watched its return collapse from 16.6% to 6.7%.
It's like if you want to become a better painter, you don't just buy a Picasso. You now own a phenomenal, irreplaceable asset. But because it is irreplaceable, you paid a massive premium for it.
Exactly.
And that premium, meaning you have to record all that goodwill on your balance sheet just for the brand and the market position, instantly acts like an anchor on your return rate.
The asset enters your books at the inflated price you pay today, not at the original, highly efficient value that produced the seller's high return in the first place.
The arithmetic of premiums is unforgiving.
Irreplaceability is exactly what makes the premium so expensive, which mathematically guarantees the destruction of the acquirer's rate. Which brings us to the third and final option, rebuild the machine itself.
This is where we resolve the Coca-Cola versus PepsiCo dilemma from our introduction.
Yes. Between 2015 and 2018, Coca-Cola engaged in a deliberate, highly publicized, decade-long retreat. They systematically sold off their bottling operations.
And by doing this on purpose, their top-line revenue plummeted by 25%.
It did. But their operating margins surged from 22.4% to 31.1%, and their return on invested capital doubled.
They intentionally shrank their capacity to absorb capital in exchange for a much higher rate of return on what remained. They traded quantity for rate.
Yes, and PepsiCo made the exact opposite choice in 2010. They bought their bottlers back. They explicitly kept their direct delivery network. Their base grew by more than 50%.
But their rate held perfectly steady at 15.5%.
Coca-Cola chose to keep the rate. PepsiCo chose to retain the capacity to absorb capital. Neither strategy is inherently wrong, but they represent entirely different architectural paths for a mature business dealing with surplus.
But this brings us to a treacherous analytical trap for anyone managing a portfolio. Rebuilding a base, like option three, and buying a base, like option two, look dangerously identical from the outside.
They look very similar on a balance sheet.
Both involve committing enormous sums of capital. Both compress reported returns in the short term. And critically, both are aggressively sold to Wall Street in quarterly earnings calls under the exact same banner of growth.
This is where we see the phenomenon playing out on a massive scale today. I mean, look at the modern technology infrastructure build-out. Microsoft, Alphabet, and Meta are currently building physical bases of a size that the legacy railroads never even contemplated.
It's unprecedented scale.
They are acquiring the physical capacity to absorb capital massive AI data centers, energy infrastructure that software businesses traditionally never possessed.
So if buying a base crushes your returns, I look at Microsoft and Meta pouring billions into data centers today, and my instinct is that they are walking right into this trap.
It's a valid concern.
They are buying a base, inflating their capital intensity, and destroying their historical rate of return.
Yeah.
Am I misreading the terrain here? How do I apply a rigorous framework to know if they're actually rebuilding a machine or just, you know, setting fire to their spread?
You're touching on the defining debate in technology investing today, but you have to separate them using three rigorous tests provided in The Infinite Investor. You can actually spot the difference before the returns materialize.
Okay, what is the first test?
The first test is financing. Is the massive new spending generated internally from operating cash flow, or is it raised from debt and equity markets? Look at Microsoft. They generate roughly $170 billion of operating cash flow against $97 billion in capital expenditure.
So it's internally funded.
Completely. They issue no equity, and they actually reduce long-term debt while building. Alphabet, conversely, has run negative free cash flow during its build-out, raising tens of billions in notes and equity to fund the gap.
Wow. Okay, and the second test is billing. And this seems crucial. Does the new massive base bill third parties? Or does it merely serve its owner as an internal cost center?
This distinction is where the architecture truly diverges. Microsoft's new capacity is contracted in commercial obligations ahead of delivery. Through Azure, they are renting out compute power to third parties for cash. It bills external clients. It acts as a toll.
But Meta doesn't do that.
No. Meta's infrastructure is consumed almost entirely internally by Meta to train its own algorithms and serve its own ads. It bills no one. It acts effectively as a cost center wearing the costume of an asset.
Fascinating. And the third test?
Time and tone. Rebuilding a machine is a grueling, decade-long program. It's usually announced to the market as a strategic retreat. Coca-Cola shrank its revenue by a quarter and frankly admitted that was the plan.
While buying a base?
Is a quarterly transaction. It's paid for with a massive premium and loudly announced to the market as immediate growth. The former admits the reality of the crossroads. The latter pretends the terrain is still flat.
We have spent this deep dive rigorously examining the structural constraints of the business. But we have to conclude by examining the constraint to the investor.
Yes, the constraint shifts.
Because holding a business long enough means its structural constraint inevitably becomes your structural constraint.
The defining constraint of the investor is size. Let us look at one of the most famous investors in Coca-Cola who first purchased the stock in 1988 during its high-growth asset-light phase.
Right.
Decades later, that same investor shifted immense amounts of capital away from consumer brands and into capital-heavy railroads and regulated energy platforms. Why? It was not a sudden change in investment philosophy or personal taste. It was a fundamental shift in his binding constraint.
When you operate with small capital, you are constrained solely by rate. Your money can go anywhere, so it naturally flows to where the percentage returns are highest.
But when you are deploying hundreds of billions of dollars, you are constrained by quantity. A modest return on a massive heavy base mathematically beats a magnificent percentage return on an asset-light base that is simply too small to absorb your capital.
Which leads to the ultimate empowering realization for you, the listener. The positions that are permanently closed to the largest institutional investors in the world remain entirely open to you.
Your distinct edge in the market is your size. You are not forced to buy the railroad just to deploy capital. What an owner truly buys is never a static historical rate of return. It is a mechanical position caught at a specific moment in its life cycle that is already traveling.
Look closely at your own portfolio today. Don't just look at the historical averages. Are the companies you own actually compounding internally, absorbing their own surplus to build a wider base? Or have they already hit the invisible crossroads, quietly externalizing the problem and handing the burden of compounding right back to you? This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.